Hi. There's a lot of familiar faces in here, some that I don't know. My name is Judy. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you very much for the card, and I like the fact that you passed it before I spoke. So if any of you wish to cross your names off later, you know, I won't take offense. I promise no resentments. I need to tell you I'm nervous. I've been around for a bit. I've been here with continuous sobriety since 3/24/1986. Not my first go around with AA though. So I'll give you a little bit about background. The thing that scares me, if I was talking to one of you, I'd monopolize the whole conversation. We'd go on for 8 hours. But when there's a group of people, I get nervous. And there is a group of people here today, and I am a bit nervous. All right, a little bit about my background. I am Lakota on both sides of my family. My mom and dad were born and raised on Standing Rock Indian Reservation. My mother on the North Dakota side, my father on the South Dakota side. On my father's side, just to give you all of my ancestry, part of my qualification, is Métis, which is French Indian from Canada. And he came down and he married back into Indians and whatnot. And my grandfather, he landed up marrying a Welsh woman. On my mother's side, she, her mother was full blood. Her mother was a deaf mute, had a fever when she was a child. She was one of many, many people. Her grandmother was what they call a Santisu. Her grandmother, original Indian name was translated to Brown Tents, but after she went down to the Indian boarding schools, which probably a lot of you may have heard about, the nuns ran that. It was a Catholic school. One of her daughters had gotten beaten by a nun. And my great-grandmother heard about it. And she went down and she grabbed that nun by the habit and swung her around and whopped her good. And so her name was therefore changed to Strong Woman. She was married to an Irishman who had migrated here from Ireland sometime during the potato famine or thereabouts, whatever. He served in the Union Army. My grandmother, who was had the fever and was a deaf mute, she married a German, and I do believe his name was Hermann Haydn originally. Now Hermann got himself into trouble in Wyoming. He and his brother Rudolph. I think it was rustling. That's the family legend. They had to hightail it out of Wyoming. They landed up in the Dakotas. My grandfather, Herman, thought it best to change his name. Evidently, there may have been some wanted signs out. So he became, and God knows why he chose this, but he became Herman Bailey. So he then, I guess, became sort of Irish. But anyway, he married my grandmother, who was a deaf mute. Now, my thoughts about this are that he married her for her land, because this was after the Dawes Act, and I won't go into all the history. Most of you probably don't care about that. But when they settled Indians on reservations, often they were allotted a certain amount of land on the reservation to claim as their own. So he married her. My grandmother had quite a bit of land, evidently. And They had a bunch of kids, six of which survived. My grandmother could not speak, could not hear, but she could hear vibrations. She raised these kids. Her husband, the German, Herman, he did a lot of cooking for ranchers and cowboying. Anyway, what ultimately happened was my grandmother, after her last child, her last pregnancy, died. And so what happened was the baby was farmed out to another family. My mother, who was the eldest daughter, and her brothers and one sister, they sort of hung out by themselves. He took up quite early with another woman, as my mother called her, the stepmother. The stepmother had a bunch of kids of her own and really didn't want any part of these Indian kids. So the kids all went to Indian school. He sold off the land and took the new wife and the kids to Wyoming. Evidently, the wanted posters had been taken down or something, but he went back and took back his old name. So that's that side. Now, on my father's side, they had a ranch. My grandfather was evidently pretty good about managing everything, but after World War I, the cattle market fell to the bottom. The military didn't need cattle. They also didn't need horses anymore. The military was becoming mechanized. All of this has to do with what happened. I'll get down to my alcoholism here in a minute. He, my grandfather, who was very, you know, was half Indian, looked very, very much full blood. He took up bootlegging. Mm-hmm. Now, this is where it's, that's yours. You don't want me to do that. Mm-hmm. I think I may have stopped it. You may come forward. I will tell you the rest of it. Pause for refreshment if you wish to go out or leave. That's okay. Anyways, sorry, I thought that was mine. Anyway, I'll get to it here in a minute. I'm sorry. Okay, so anyway, Al Capone, everybody knows who Al Capone was? Okay.
Yes.
He had an older brother, and his original name was, I don't remember what his first name is, but the middle name was Vincenzo Capone. Well, he, unlike his younger brother, said, enough of this. He changed his name to James something Hart. And he was a prohibition agent that worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And my grandfather got busted by Al Capone's brother. So everything always comes full circle. So now about alcoholism and me, or my thing. I'm the first generation off the reservation. My dad was worked for the government his whole life, served in World War II, was a raging alcoholic. He also was a decorated war hero. Pulled men out of a burning tank, but he was a raging alcoholic. He had told me that, I don't know exactly when he started drinking, but, you know, he was a blackout drinker right from the get-go. My mother's side of the family, I told you pretty much about them. They landed up in Indian schools. My mother never really lived at home again. My mother and father, because of World War II, met in San Diego. And as a result of my mother's younger brother being thrown in the brig for drinking. He was 16 in the Marine Corps. He was going to be shipped out. That's how my mother and father met. And voila, here I am. Here I am. I talked about my dad. He was my first higher power. And he was a higher power in the respect that he terrified me. You never could depend on what he was going to do. If he was sober, he was irritable and discontented. If he was drinking, God knows what went through his head. The upshot of the deal is I learned how very early on to walk on eggshells. My first clear memory of my father was throwing records. I guess they were 78s, whatever the old records were. When he came home from work, my brother and I had been playing with them evidently and scratched them. And he went to put them on the record player. And when he found they scratched, he threw them at us. And I was, from that moment on, the beginning of, for me, terror. Now, I will add this. I don't blame my father for my alcoholism. He was my higher power. I see clearly now that I spent a lot of my life trying to be the person that he wanted to be, him for me to be, and I clearly see also that I was pretty nervous, pretty repressed, and pretty stressed all of the time. I was responsible for my brothers growing up when my mother and dad went out. My mom wasn't much of a drinker. I didn't have any big glamorous stories to tell about anything going on about then, except that there was a lot of abuse in that house. Both verbal and physical, and it played a toll. It played a big toll. We were also supposed to get good grades. I did. My brothers, you know, we all had an opportunity to go to college. My brothers both graduated. I dropped out. My big foray into being a big a rebellion was the day I walked from across the street in high school to the smoking lot, where I truly believed all of the cool kids were. I mean, I graduated in 1963, so, I mean, that was way back in the day. Smoking was, you know, sort of marked you, and I so desperately wanted to be bad because I was so sick of being good. I also had a very low self-image. The first time I had a taste of alcohol, I'll just mention, was when I was about four, and one of my uncles gave me a sip of beer, or a glug of beer. Only thing why it's worth mentioning is I remember it.
Yeah.
And that's a long time to remember one glug of beer. My next foray into feeling different was I'd always had a weight problem up and down. I used to, probably do still sometimes, I'd eat when I was stressed. So my doctor, when I was about 13, 14, put me on diet pills, otherwise known as Bennies or whatever you want to call them. And they worked. So he asked me, I'd have to go in and get a checkup. He asked me how I was doing, and I said, at first they were great. I dropped some weight. I felt energetic. And then I went in, and he says, well, how's it going? He says, I noticed you've gained a couple of pounds. And I said, well, those pills don't seem to be working. And, and he looked at me, and he gave me the recipe of life. He said, double up. And I want to tell you that the last time anybody had to tell me to double up on anything ever again. So that was sort of the beginning of that. When first time I really, really got drunk was in high school, girls' slumber party. I was a bit of a know-it-all. After all, I was the oldest child. I was supposed to know everything. I was supposed to take care of my younger brothers when my parents went out. There was a lot of supposed to's for me. And so we had this slumber party, and parents had a wonderful big liquor cabinet. And I, because I'd been watching my father drink forever, and I'd heard something about, you're not supposed to mix drinks. So we're taking a little out of all the bottles, and I, because I know so much, decided to take only the brown liquor. Now, it didn't matter whether it was scotch, it didn't matter whether it was brandy, it didn't matter whether it was bourbon or anything else that was brown. And I drank. And what happened was, because I wasn't going to quit, one, I sort of liked the buzz, but the other thing was, all these other girls were stopping their drinking after a certain point. Not me, you know. I was going to do, you know, I was going to complete this foray into rebelliousness. And these girls started pouring a little bit of their drinks into my drink. And I finished it all, and I got rip-roaring sick. First time I ever promised God, let me live through this. I'll never do it again. So going forward, I married, and when I was 19 years old, I married. I clearly see now, not then, that I married to get out of the house. Part of why I got married was because, and we're all adults here, part of why I got married was this. I was pregnant. Now, how did I get pregnant? I'll tell you how I got pregnant.
Wait a minute. Give me a minute.
I had no big experience with men up to that point. Didn't date in high school. I had dates for the proms and everything, but my dad was very formidable when any boys, even friends, came to the house, and so it was, you know, I was pretty naive about a lot of things. So I get to San Francisco State. Everything was going on there. I saw bulletins on the board that said, guys looking for female roommate. I was just astounded that this was on a bulletin board. And my husband came to visit a girlfriend there on campus in full marine dress blues. And she evidently wasn't interested in him anymore, but he became very interested in me. And now how I got pregnant. Well, I decided that it was time to get rid of this virginity, you know, curse that I had going on. And so, you know, the deed was going to be done. And I asked him, because I'd heard you needed protection to keep from getting pregnant, whether he had protection and was he using it? And he said, yes. And I wasn't going to look at that thing.
Oh my God.
And lo and behold, I was pregnant.
Oh my God.
And I got married, so and my drinking, by this time I had been drinking every time. My drinking wasn't every day or anything, but any time I drank, I drank until I was loaded. I couldn't stop until there was no more alcohol, and I would get loaded. After I got married, that sort of progressed on. And every time I drank, I'd get loaded. And I liked the feeling of all of that. So I miscarried that child because of German measles. I had German measles. We went on my marriage. My husband went to Vietnam. He came back. Unfortunately, we were not well matched at all. He came from also an alcoholic family. And they say water, you know, you come to your same level. He was abusive, and much like me, I was not a good communicator. Really, I could tell you about a book I read, but interpersonal relationships, not a good communicator about what I needed, what I wanted, what I didn't want. And neither was he. And so a lot of the arguments landed up with being abusive. And even though I am short, I always thought I could handle things that I couldn't. And that marriage broke up, and it was broke up on a very unhappy note. By that time, we had a child. And now, you see, my dad had died, my husband was gone, and I could now jump into drinking full force, and that's exactly what I did. There was no, from there on in, I don't know whether it, what line might have been or not been, but I started drinking. I liked bar drinking. I liked hanging out in bars. I liked dark bars. Till this day, if I pass a bar room, and I'm talking about a bar room, not some fancy sushi place, if the door opens and that odor from a bar comes wafting out, my mouth will water. I liked that. I liked alcohol. I liked hard alcohol. Now, in the beginning of the book, it talks a lot about, all the things one might do to mitigate your drinking. My problem, I thought, was more or less not staggering, not passing out. So there were things I tried. I mean, I tried everything in the book, coating your stomach with oil, eating, milk, whatever else that might. I also tried switching alcohol, but it always came around. For me, it was hard liquor. And when I quit drinking or stopped drinking the first time, I was a big, big fan of tequila, Russian vodka, and scotch. Those were the drinks that I preferred, and I didn't like them mixed. Anyway, along came with this. I have the disease of more. Mm-hmm. So after I was divorced, it seemed to me that I had been deprived in my high school years of fun. And I felt that it was time for me starting to have fun. And for me, that equated to men. And so drinking, smoking, yes, Karen, and men were a large part of what I enjoyed most, men who drank. And so I did that very, very well, I might say. And I did it to the point where I began to have a lot of guilt and shame because, you see, I had this little girl. I was fortunate enough to have a mother who was taking care of her when I was out romping around. But it got to a point where I was beginning to feel really, really guilty, really, really ashamed of myself because I was waking up with people I didn't know and places I'd never been to. I also, at one point, had been on Lake Shasta in a houseboat, and I believed that what I was having was auditory hallucinations. I believed everyone was talking about me. And the person I was with had told me that I needed to go and lay down and stay there. And he was staying with me to make sure I stayed there. So anyway, there was that. There was also the fact that I'd land up in the hospital after a breakup with a person. I had been drinking, it was tequila. I was in a great deal of pain. You see, this person I really thought I loved. And I don't know why he didn't think I was such a catch, but evidently it might have been my behavior. what happened was I drank. I had also had a lot of tranquilizers prescribed to me because, I had a lot of stress and, I just needed these things, and I had a bunch of them. So the pain didn't go away from the breakup. So what are you going to do? You go in and take a few Librium, and you drink some more, and you take some more Librium, and you drink some more. And my mother, I do not know how, showed up at my apartment, probably to bring me back my child. I'm not sure how. I landed up in the hospital. First time I was told by a medical professional that I had to stop drinking. Now, he told me that after I was in the hospital for a day or two. And it was after some of my friends, all male, had come to the hospital to see me and bring me cocktails in cans. And so I had, I don't know, 5 or 6 cans of cocktails under the sheets. My doctor came in, and I'd known him forever, and admonished me, "You've got to stop drinking," you know. He had known my father. He knew that what kind of person my father was. "You have to stop drinking." And I nodded yes. And he left, and I drank the cocktails. And that was that. But anyways, very soon, shame, guilt, and whatever. And there was a fellow who I liked. He was a very good man, I might add, who really cared about me and was foolish enough to ask me to marry him. And I, at this point, felt like, okay, I don't love him. You know, I like him a lot, but I don't love him. And he can't hurt me, you know, meaning break off with me, because he doesn't, you know, because I don't have that much invested, I thought. So I married him, and he used to drink with me. But after we got married, I guess this whole thing about having a little girl in the house and trying to be, you know, a person who might have some responsibility now, he stopped drinking except for maybe a glass of wine at dinner, you know, occasional. And I didn't really like that. You see, what I wanted is I wanted the veneer of respectability. I wanted to be a wife. I thought that maybe I could, you know, stay within those bounds, whatever. And that didn't work out. And why it didn't work out? See, all this time, I was able to keep a job at a major airline. I was, at this point, working in maintenance. The position I held at that time was mechanics helper, so don't worry, I wasn't wrenching on airplanes at that point. I was handing out tools. And there was this fellow that came along, and he just thought I was great. And you know what? He drank. And it wasn't long, you know. He was tall and good looking. Unfortunately, my husband was short. He was good looking, but he wasn't drinking. So I looked at this guy and he said, "How about we go get a drink after work?" And I said, "Why, sure." And you know where that led to. He and I started off on a road that led to the end of my marriage in a very, very short period of time. I might add that to those two husbands, I ultimately made amends to, both the first one and the second one. The first one I made an amends to based on the idea that there was, I was not the person that was doing the abuse, but you know, I also was not extremely kind to him afterwards either. And I just thought I should square away my part of the deal. And my part of the deal was being sort of passive aggressive to him, not doing anything violent, but getting even in subtle ways. The second husband, I had very clear-cut amends to. I was unfaithful, and it humiliated him. I might also tell you that I worked at a major airline, ultimately in maintenance, and all three of my husbands, plus numerous boyfriends, were all employed at that major airline. For me, you see, it was like putting the one hen in a rooster coop. It was mine for the taking. And I want to tell you that, going back to my dad, this is my personal belief. Fathers are the first love of a little girl's life. And it doesn't matter what kind of father you are, really. First love of your life. And if a girl, or at least some girls, don't get the kind of attention and validation from that first love, they're often apt to make poor choices around men later on. And my dad's guidance for me was essentially, they all want to get into your pants, period. And, you know, and I was never quite, was good enough for him about everything. I mean, if I got a B, it should have been an A. If I, you know, if I stepped out of line, it shouldn't have happened. There was no room for just growing up, making some small decisions for oneself. Anyway, good, I'm using up the time. I'm even going to get sober here in a minute. So after I stayed with this fellow that I had been drinking with, we lived together for a number of years, and he landed up in a hospital because, well, I had gone to break up with him because I could see that he was drinking too much. My mother had come down to take charge of my daughter. She was going to take her to live with her because I was not doing very well. And I had not lost my job yet, which was a miracle. I went to break up with this fellow, and he said to me, let's go out one last time, you know, like one for the road, sort of, so to speak. And I had put my daughter that day in a summer camp, and up in Marin, I had come down to Sausalito and gone in to a bar and had several drinks because I was going to go and break up with this fellow, and I needed a little liquid courage. So by the time I got home, and this was in Pacifica, I had quite a bit to drink. He, on the other hand, had been at home drinking. So I said, sure, we'll go out one last time. And we got into his car, and he took off, and it was a residential street. He was going close to 100 miles an hour, rounded a corner, drove down the way, and deliberately put us into a light pole, a telephone pole thing. And he landed up in jail. I landed up in the hospital with some cuts and everything. I was lucky I still had a seatbelt on because it was a convertible top. At this point, because I'm an active alcoholic drinker with low self-esteem, with grandiose ideas, and a whole bunch of other screwed up thinking, I did what was logical to do. I went and I bailed that son of a gun out. I bailed him out of. And we continued to live together for a bit more. And I bought another house. The place we were living in was my condo. I bought another house, told him he finally had to leave, and because I had that place up for sale, and he left. And then during that time, when he had been in, oh, I forgot this part. He had been in, after he got out of jail, he was in a recovery program, and the recovery program were talking to me as his significant other, and they kept telling me I had to stop drinking. And that's where I came into contact with AA the first time. I kept telling them, if you get him straightened out, I'll be fine. And they kept insisting, no, that wouldn't work. You at least had to get rid of the alcohol because he would never stay sober if you were drinking and in the house. So and they said, I think you really should investigate AA. Might be good for you. So off I went. I eventually poured alcohol down. I'll show them. And I went off to AA. And I sort of liked it. I mean, it was at the San Mateo Lana Club. It was 1977, and I was 32 years old. I had put in a lot of drinking in a very short period of time, and I got a sponsor. I did the steps, not thoroughly, you understand, because I felt there were some things that I was still quite ashamed of, that I just didn't feel anyone needed to know about. And this God thing, I've been pretty pissed off at God because he had put me in a family with my father and a whole bunch of other stuff. So what happened was I was able to sort, you know, go to meetings, meet with a sponsor, do a half-hearted thing of the steps, and I managed to stay sober for over 7 years until I came to Benicia. And what happened there was this. You guys just didn't do it the right way. I had a nickname in my other AA group, something they should have never put on a person like me. They called me, and no one else has permission to call me this, was Cutie Judy. I was, you know, it was not good for a person with an ego like mine. I did not need that, but I thought it was grand. You know, I was a little star. And so anyway, nobody was calling me Cutie Judy up here. Maggie, who you all know, stomping around in these wood heels at the time and couldn't sit down during that period of time. And I thought, oh, this is for the birds, you know. And I stopped going to AA. And I was commuting down to the peninsula to my work. It took up a lot of time. Had this daughter that was growing up, who, by the way, at that point thought that she was never going to have a problem with her mother again. Mm. Right? She had stopped smelling my 7-Up, my club soda, my water to see if it was drinking. And there I was. So I stopped. And what happened was in 1985, we went out for an oh, I got married again, by the way. I will read this. It's in Bondage. And my current sponsor thinks this is a scream. It's, where did that go? It's in the very last story in this, almost. Freedom from Bondage. This caused the comment from one of my AA friends when I told my story after coming into the program, that I had always been a cinch for the program, for I had always been interested in mankind. I was just taking them one man at a time. So anyway, I had married again another guy from United, excuse me, poor United, I'm defaming them. And I married again. You guys weren't doing AA right. I suspected my daughter might be drinking a little bit in high school. She was her senior at this time. My husband was drinking. I was building resentments. Everybody was getting relief. I wasn't. And so went out for an anniversary. He had a glass of red wine. It sparkled. It was on a white tablecloth. I always imagined that I drank like a lady. And there was this beautiful glass of wine, and I said, just let me have a sip of that. And I did. I had a sip of it. And I sat there and I thought, I'm not going to order another glass of wine. I can handle this. This was all a mistake. It was all, you know, I was young. It was that last guy I was living with, nothing to do with me. And I started an experiment that lasted for 4 months to determine whether I was alcoholic or not. And what it landed up was on March 23rd, my daughter had gone to Santa Cruz for a senior whatever trip. My husband was going to work overtime. And I, on the other hand, sat down with, we had a big liquor cabinet, I might add, that I had, you know, sat down, and I had been sneaking these liquors from the back of the cabinet and hiding the bottles under the sink. I sat down to to watch because I'm sophisticated. PBS, Yan Can Cook, and a bottle of wine. And the next thing I remember is my husband had come home, put a blanket over me, and thought that I might be sick, noticed that I had the phone off the hook, and there was a glass of what he thought was orange juice on the night table. And he took a slug of that. God knows, I never really cared for screwdrivers, but evidently I had made myself one. I was passed out, I was foul-mouthed, I was horrible. And my husband then called a good friend of mine, and he said, take her to Duffy's. She never wanted to go there. And that's where I landed up, at Duffy's for 28 days. And the first 2 weeks, I was a mixture of anger. I was a mixture of shame and guilt. My daughter had been, you know, when we left the house, I could hear her wailing and crying. Because I was loaded. I was loaded. And here it was her senior year, right? Supposed to be the best year of a kid's high school life. And so I got a sponsor after 28 days. A lot of you, or some of you, knew her. Her name was Annie. She's gone now, Annie Lloyd. She was short. The woman she showed up at my house with was a gal named Kathy Joseph, who happens to be my son-in-law's mother. Both members of this program, both passed away now. And they started taking me to meetings. I went to my first meeting at St. Paul's in the evening. Second meeting I went to was women's meeting on Monday nights. And if those walls could talk in that particular church, what a tale they would have to tell, because there was a lot of weeping and wailing, there was a lot of blaming. You know, I was not settling down very well. But my sponsor, she had some rules. I had to call her, I had to make a gratitude list, I had to go to the meeting she prescribed, and I had to meet with her once a week, and we were going to go through that book, and we were going to go through those steps. And that's what I did. That's what I did. I got into service. I sponsored people. I helped with the Christmas party. I was on intergroup for a while. I was a GSR over here for a while. And that's the way it continued for a long, long time. I have a lot of good friends over here. And those friends supported me through my my early sobriety, which was not fun. They supported me through my mother's passing away. My mother was the solid rock in our family. She was the one. She was not a drinker. One of my fondest memories of her was kneeling by the bed, praying. My relationship with my higher power did not get off to a good start. My sponsor, Annie, said I could borrow hers. But I kept working at it. I kept working at it. I did not have any blinding flash. I'd been raised as a Christian. So I, you know, said had some elements of that, but, you know, it just didn't ever seem really solid to me at that time. You know, you can have a lot of bottoms. And my big bottom came as far as the end of my sobriety. My mother's passing was certainly one of them. But the big one was, after 28 years of marriage, my marriage broke up. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, this time, it was not my idea. And I was crushed. And there's a few of the women in here who know all about that, because I wept, wailed. I was not graceful. I'd like to tell you I was. I was not graceful about it at all. It hurt. And but I'll tell you what the gift was. The gift, there were two gifts out of this. One gift was hindsight, not at the moment. Hindsight, I could see that the marriage had not been happy for a bit of time, probably quite a bit of time. The second gift was because of this, and because of this failure of a third marriage, my ego, right? My ego. I developed a reliance on my higher power, my God, as I understand him, her, it, whatever you guys choose to call it. I went through the next year, I was going to 3 meetings a day, most days. I was walking around saying God's will, not my will, constantly. I learned how to let go of a lot of different things in that marriage. There were so many different elements that I had to let go of, including my stepchildren. They were so upset, both at their father and me, that this happened. I'd known them for a long, long time. I don't know what I would have done without AA. See, the day, the part of it was, my brother's an alcoholic. In my first round of, quote, sobriety, first time way back, I introduced him to AA. And when all this happened, for about a month, I didn't see anybody. I was so distraught. I was just in turmoil. And my brother came over to see me. My house had begun to look like the Addams Family. The plants were all dead. You know, nothing had been done. The dishes were piling up. And I'd come to the point where I needed to do something. And it was closest I've ever come to drinking. I was either going to drink, couldn't stand the pain, the thought of, you know, possibly doing myself in, you know, certainly passed through my mind. No plan, just the thought, pain so great. And the last one was getting a hold of my sponsor. So my brother came over, takes one look at me, and he says, yeah, you gotta call your sponsor. And then the other thing, he said, we're gonna get you to the doctor. I was in a profound depression, and they put me on antidepressant. Now, I will tell you this, that all my life I'd had little bouts of depression. This was a big one, if you will. And that helped. I will never interfere with anybody who's on prescribed medication.
That's right.
I will never fault them for that. I don't take the early doctor's advice of taking double. I do as I am told. So I did all that, still sponsoring people. Ultimately, I had to leave the wonderful city of Benicia. I believe that JJ used to say this was the best place to get sober, or the center of all sobriety. JJ had all these things about Benicia being the greatest of everything. And I left and I went across the bridge. I went to Concord. And I went to Concord. Barbara and Steve came from Concord over here. And then I know there were other people that came over here. I ultimately got a new sponsor over here. She's sitting right there. We sort of sponsor each other. I volunteer her for stuff, she volunteers me for stuff. Currently, as a result of her volunteering, I am a GSR. I am in service at my meetings. I go to 3 or 4 meetings a week. I sponsor people. My Annie told me, and I believe this, she says, you can't go wrong sponsoring people as long as you stick to the program. And her thought was, and I do believe this for myself and for other people, the program is never wrong. It's only the person. And that would reflect back on my first sobriety. You know, it says, who thoroughly followed his path. And I didn't the first time around. Second time around, I certainly have. And And I all wish you well, and God, I was so afraid of not talking. Now, if you'd like an encore, I can go on another 30 minutes, but I think that probably it's best I stop now and let you know that I certainly feel that it's an honor to have been able to speak here. You guys have been so cordial and so wonderful, and all I can say is God be with all of you. Now, here's the card if anyone wants to cross off their names.
We won't change the card at all.
Here you go. That's for your...